Politically Confused.
Escaping Oz, an observer's reflection by my guest, my brother, my friend, Jim Mascai. How are you, brother?
Hey, Larry, I'm out ready to do some breakdancing over here.
There you go, bro. Old school, man. I love it. I love it. Hey, man, before we get started, first of all, thank you for being on with me tonight. Thank you for sending me the proof copy of Escaping Oz. Wonderful book. Gets my endorsement fully. Five beards, two cowboy hats, and a hallelujah is the highest review I can give you. And, of course, you got that. But before we get into it, brother, why don't you tell my listeners a little bit about yourself?
Well, one thing that I like to do when I introduce myself to audiences that don't know me is that I'm not from the United States. I'm actually an immigrant to the United States. I'm from the Republic of Panama, and English was not my first language. It was actually Spanish. So it tends to fool people a little bit when they don't hear, a Spanish accent behind the voice. Presently, I am running a consulting company called Sentinel Consulting. We help small businesses with business consulting issues that are, you know, relevant and germane to small businesses, alternative financing and debt restructuring. A lot of what I've done, Larry, over the course of the last few years has kind of prepared me to understand the economy, the financial markets. And, you know, you were talking earlier about the Oz and, you know, who's the man behind the curtain, and trying to bring some of that expertise to smaller businesses.
That's an absolute blessing. I'm glad you're out there helping people, man, especially small businesses. Let's talk about small businesses for a second before we get into our little Q&A. But small businesses, so many come and so many go. Is it a financial thing? Is it a product thing? Is it what is it about small businesses? You got a great idea and a great vision. What is it that so many don't even get off the ground? What is it in your expertise?
I wrote an article for a local small business magazine here in St. Louis, where I'm located, a couple of years ago, and I talked about the challenges that small businesses face. And in this country, you know, if you believe that you're going to improve the economic health of this country, it has to absolutely start with small businesses. In the article, I concluded the article by saying that, you know, you look at a company like Apple, they started in a garage with two people. You know, where's the next Apple going to come from? You know, where's the next Google? We have to nurture these small businesses. The problem is when you look at in this country, there's, I think it was like 3.8 million businesses that were between one and five employees. And of course, you know, the larger the firm size, the fewer those firms you have. After 2008, which we all know was a watershed year in the United States economy, the number of small business births was started to fall below deaths. So you're actually in a very, very bad trend right now, where business deaths are outnumbering business births, and then you have a higher concentration of people that then are going to work for larger firms. That obviously has some adverse effects for the economy from an employment standpoint, obviously from an economic vitality standpoint. But typically what happens with a lot of these firms is there's a general financial condition that becomes adverse at some point in time that tends to then worsen and eventually potentially ends in a catastrophe or something, you know, that they're out of the business either through legal means or their own volition. But the key decisions that small businesses make along the course of time are very, very tied to, you know, their financial aspects. And we all know that small businesses are the owners are very, very good at what they do. And a lot of them work in the business. But obviously, you know, having that mindset, the proper financial controls that small businesses need to have. And I've worked for large companies, so I kind of understand that part of it. That tends to get overlooked. And the small business owner obviously has to wear a lot of hats. So the goal of my consulting firm is to try to bring some of that expertise to a small business so they can, you know, prosper and survive, because we want them to, because obviously it helps the economy.
Amen, amen, amen. America, world, family, church, listen, I'm on with author and business consultant, Jim Mascara. Am I pronouncing your last name? I don't like when people mess up my daddy's name, so make sure I'm pronouncing it right.
Yeah, you can just say it Mascara. Since it's a Spanish name, of course, your folks in Texas are very familiar with the Spanish language. I would say it in Spanish, I would say Mosquera.
Ah, Mosquera. Well, in Texas, we would say Jim M.
There you go.
I love it. I love it, man. America, world, family, I'm on with Jim Mosquera, author and business consultant, but author of a series of books. We're talking about Escaping Oz and Observer's Reflection. We're going to get into it. He's going to give you the carrot. You got to buy the steak, man. All right. You know how we do this, man. We bless our authors. We bless them. We'll give you an overview, give you highlights, but you buy the steak and you bless this man because he was bold enough and inspired enough to put pen to paper and get and bless us with something that will educate the masses. Escaping Oz and Observer's Reflection. Jim, what inspired the book, bro?
Well, several years ago, I was in a large company and I was working in the telecommunications field. I was always pretty good at writing and communicating, you know, whether it was delivering presentations in a corporate environment or just writing reports, responding to requests for proposals. But I have kind of always been around money, whether I was trading commodities, kind of learning about the economy. And even though my academic background is not paralleled at all to anything related to finance, you know, economics or anything like that, I'm actually an engineer by degree. I try to use that discipline that I gain when I achieve my engineering degree to kind of learn more about the economy. And over the course of time, and really beginning around 2009, I started to do some publishing about the financial markets, more in a newsletter format. That led me to create my first Escaping Oz book in late 2010, early 2011, that, again, was very, very geared towards protecting people's financial wealth. And again, it wasn't about hitting a home run. It was really more about, you know, hitting a single, you know, bunting the runner over to second base, to kind of trying to take a different approach to it, because I became very, very convinced, you know, working in a corporate environment and being around people, you know, that made good salaries and were generally very educated, that there was a paucity of knowledge about how things work, particularly, you know, money, the economy, you know, what people understood to be the wizards, which, again, the wizards in the book are referred to people like central bankers, the Federal Reserve, you know, people in government, the government in and of itself. And really, as you mentioned in the description, the book is really a lot about education. And that's really the goal, is to try to educate people, because as we progress through life, and, you know, we achieve or we acquire more and more responsibilities, you know, it's really, really hard to guide something unless we can ask the right questions, you know, and the questions that need to be asked are questions of our, you know, political leaders and our financial leaders. And we're very much at a crossroads right now in this country. Obviously, the political aspect is certainly prevalent right now. But there's a theme that I talk about in all the books, which is that intersection of politics and economics. And when those two things intersect, it's very, very explosive.
And we see those things intersecting right now with every bill that's attempted to be passed or written or thrown out or killed in Congress right now. Politics and economics, man. What do you think is going to happen or what's going on with healthcare?
I'm glad you asked that question, Larry, because that's a discussion that, again, people aren't really asking the right questions. And when I look at the political spectrum in the United States, you know, we define it, I would say the media and in general, they tend to define it very, very narrowly. They you're either Republican or a Democrat, and it's portrayed as left or right. In the last book that you mentioned, Escaping Oz, An Observer's Reflections, I define the political spectrum actually much, much wider than that. And if you really look at the true political spectrum, it starts on one end with anarchy, which is no one's in charge. And on the other end, you have what I'll call the isms, communism, fascism, socialism. When this country first got started, we were, if you take that spectrum and you have kind of a center line for it, let's say we were probably closer to that center point. You know, we started this country not even with the Constitution as we know it, but we had something called the Articles of Confederation. So we had even had a very loose arrangement with the states and the federal government. We made it a little bit more federal, obviously, with the Constitution, but there were certain rights that were attached to, you know, the Bill of Rights that were attached to that Constitution. What we've done now, Larry, is we've actually taken both parties and we've slid them much more to that end that have the isms in it. So when I hear people talking about the left and right, to me, they're actually a very narrow portion of that broad political spectrum that we talked about, that I just mentioned earlier. With respect to healthcare, I was born in the Republic of Panama, where we have what would be considered in this country, and I'll use the word free in double quotations, free healthcare. When I was born in a public hospital, and this wasn't single payer. This was basically single provider, because it was a government-run hospital. Mm. By the time my sister was born a few years later, she was born in a private clinic. She had the option. My parents had the option of having her born in a public hospital, but she was born in a private clinic. The problem that I have with the discussion, Larry, about healthcare in this country right now, about which way to go with it, is that it's not really an honest discussion. In the book that you read, one of the things I pointed out was that whenever Obamacare or the Affordable Care Act was passed in 2010 or 2011, I can't remember the year, there was all this discussion about, well, this is an intrusion of government in healthcare, et cetera, et cetera. Well, if we're being intellectually honest about it, Larry, we already had a huge intrusion of the government in healthcare. We had Medicare, we had Medicaid, we had CHIP, and you know, we have the Veterans Administration. And so I actually show a statistic there that, you know, pre-Obamacare, what percentage of the American public was already covered by some either single payer or single provider healthcare in the United States? So the thing that I brought up in the second book of Escaping Oz, I said, one of the things that we need to do in this country before we have any political discussion is have a definition of what government needs to be. What do you want government to be? And define what that is. And think about that political spectrum that I talked about earlier. Do you want government to move more towards the ism side, or do you want it more towards the freedom side? And keep in mind that the more you move it towards the ism side, the more you ask government to do, the more you ask government to do, the more bureaucracy there is. And the more bureaucracy there is, the more it costs to run government. It's very, very difficult to argue that we, and I say we the people, because we're all responsible for this, haven't asked government to do way too much. How do we know that numerically? We know that numerically, Larry, because we are $20 trillion in debt, and that's funded debt. That's not even the contingent liabilities. And that's at the federal level. I'm not talking about state pensions or anything like that. So when you look at what we've asked government to do, we've asked them to do way too much.
And you know what, Jim, absolutely, absolutely correct. Said so powerfully, passionately, and eloquently. We are talking about not only his book, Escaping Oz, An Observer's Reflection, but we're just asking a couple of questions so you, the listener, can be ye edified. I'm on with author Jim. Some would say Mosqueda. Some in Texas would say Jim M. Some of my rednecks and breadnecks. And if you don't know what a breadneck is, that's a black redneck. We would just say, hey, bro, this is my brother on right now, Jim Mosqueda, my brother, man. Hey, listen. So we're talking about government and how they've intruded, how we've allowed them, how we've invited them in, Jim. Why? Here's a huge question, is that why have we made in certain communities, certain places in the United States, why have we made government our daddy?
Great question. And it's something that I address early in the book that you mentioned, Escaping Oz and Observer's Reflections. And that's because we have asked government to, when I mentioned the Constitution earlier and the Bill of Rights, those are all freedoms of something, you know, freedom of speech, freedom of religion, et cetera. That's what we wanted government to do. We wanted government to grant us those freedoms, which are inalienable rights, right? That's how it's defined in the Bill of Rights. But what we've done historically over the course of time, we've asked government to protect us from something. So there's a difference between freedom of and freedom from. And so as we've progressed through time, and it's just become more acute here probably in the last, let's say, decade or so, we're continually asking government to protect us from things. And some of those things are not necessarily consistent with what we've asked in the Bill of Rights, which is freedoms of something. And where you see it more acutely now, I would say, is in that protecting us from freedom of speech. And I'll give you a great example of this. About 3 weekends ago, for your listeners that watch 60 Minutes in the United States, there was a panel that was assembled by a pollster, and I can't remember his name right now, and he got together a group of voters from 2016 in the state of Michigan. About half voted for the 45th president, about half did not. And during the course of the discussion that was moderated actually by Oprah Winfrey, there was a person that said in this little panel, she said, well, maybe we need to limit this freedom of speech thing. And I thought that was a watershed moment, in at least in my lifetime, that somebody actually uttered that, you know, maybe this freedom of that we're, you know, that we have is an inalienable right in our Bill of Rights and as part of our Constitution. Mm-hmm. Somebody actually thought about limiting that. And then I think after she said that, even Oprah kind of got aghast and said, well, then that means that we don't have freedom of speech. That was her response. And then the lady kind of backed off a little bit. And so, but again, Larry, the key point is that, that idea came into someone's head. And so, and I'm sure that she's probably not the only one that thinks that. And so what we have right now is we've drifted so far in trying to have government or actually having government and then even asking government to potentially protect us freedom from something. And apparently some of that might be even speech. That's a very, very dangerous condition to have in the country.
Absolutely. So you talk about a slippery slope. You don't want to fall down that mountain, man. Like Jim was saying, you got to ask the right questions. Doesn't that remind you of iRobot and that little 3D thing that came up on Will Smith? You got to ask the right questions. That is the right question. Very powerful. Let's ask a question that needs to be asked. We got Bitcoins coming up. We got transaction, credit card, all this stuff. Jim, what's going on with the possibility of abolishing cash? Or is there something wrong with abolishing cash?
I wrote an article that people can access through my author site at jimmoscara.com, and I talked about that's probably one of the biggest kind of cloaked unknown dangers to your, I would say, your financial freedom, and that's the abolition of cash. There are a number of reasons why, I'll use the term wizards, the wizards would want to abolish cash. And we haven't talked about this yet, but I have a fictional series that shows the United States progressing about, you know, 5 or so years from now, where the authorities start to meddle in the financial affairs of people. And one of those things is the banishing of cash. Well, once you banish cash, it gives the wizards much more control over the economy, because then everything is seen. There's nothing that's hidden, if you will. The problem that you have with banning cash, aside from, you know, some of the freedom aspects of it, I'll give you two particular cases. Number one, recently we had, which is something that I do talk about quite a bit in my fictional series, which is cyber terror. You know, we had an admission by Equifax that all of these accounts were hacked, right? And that included probably, you know, everyone that's listening to this show in the United States. And so imagine that you were hacked, okay, and that all of a sudden your financial accounts all got locked up. You had no credit cards. Maybe something nefarious happened to your bank account. Imagine if you had none of that and you didn't have cash. You'd be in a world of hurt. Now, imagine that same situation if you had cash. You would have some support there to be able to, you know, buy groceries, food, medicine, whatever it is that you need, right? And so that's one aspect of having cash that the people don't necessarily think about, is that you not only give up your financial freedom, but there's a financial protection there that's required. I will bring up another question or another situation for you that maybe some people, perhaps not in Houston as they experienced with Hurricane Harvey, but maybe in Puerto Rico. In Puerto Rico, let's say everything, you know, they said that the communications networks were down. They had no electricity. Can you use an ATM in that environment? No, you can't. How important would cash be in that environment, in that sort of a disaster environment? Cash would be king. And so I've just given you two scenarios there where it would be imperative for a person to have cash. Now, imagine if you abolish cash, that if you were in that same situation, right? So, and again, that's getting back to that progression that I mentioned earlier, which is that drift over to the isms where, you know, you ask government to do more and more and more. Well, if you ask government to basically outsource all, you know, 100% of the monetary environment of the United States, well, part of that is basically ridding yourself of cash.
Wow. Wow. Yeah, y'all are kidding. Education, you're getting wisdom, truth, understanding, and knowledge is being revealed to you. You got to go to Jim's website. I want you not only to get the book, you got to go to jimmoscara.com. Now, I want you to get the book, but I want you to look at the other things in which Jim has in his bookstore and his resources and all that good stuff. Jim, give him some contact information, social media, website, phonetic spelling, and all that good stuff.
Yeah, the primary place probably to contact me would be on my author site, which is jimmoscara.com, and I'll spell that. That's J-I-M mosquera.com. And there you'll see all the books. You'll see links to, I actually have an online bookstore, which would be somewhat analogous to going to Amazon, where, you know, you can download, you know, not just my titles, but you can download other titles as well. I also have my books on audio. So for those that would rather listen to a book rather than read it, which I know where many people are very busy, the audio is another avenue for you to be able to listen and educate yourself as well.
Love it. Please get out there and support Brother Jim, man. I tell you what, get Escaping Odds, but you also heard him talk about his other series of books. Give us some titles of your other series.
The fictional series is with the protagonist is a journalist, and his name is Chandler Scott. So he's consistent throughout the three books. The first book is called 2020, and 2020 is the United States around the election of the year 2020, as the title would imply. And you knew how exciting and contentious our 2016 election is. Wait till you read about how I set up the 2020 election. And not just the Republican and Democratic parties, but there's actually other political parties that are part of it. And what's really interesting, Larry, is that when I see the divisiveness within the Republican Party and within the Democratic Party, it leads me to think that some of the things that I wrote about in the book that are fiction, you know, could come to fruition. But in the book 2020, something very explosive happens at the end of the book, bombshell ending. And then that leads to the second book, which is how the country reacts to what happened. And that book's called Rebellion, which is Latin for rebellion. And then something the protagonist, Chandler Scott, discovers just a very, very chilling thing in that book. And then that leads to the third book, which is called Division. And so there's a progression in each book. Each book moves faster than the one before it. And what it does is it mimics how crises happen in real life, because crises happen. They tend to kind of bubble up very, very slowly at first, and then suddenly, kind of like with an avalanche, you know, you never know which snowflake is the one that's going to start the avalanche. That's kind of the pace of the books.
That's right. That's right. I got to get those, man, because that setting up the 2020 election, you know, I did a show a couple of weeks ago talking about Hillary Clinton's 2020 run or campaign has started. I truly believe she's going to run, but I'm interested to understand your book 2020 and that, like you said, the division in the Republican, the division in the Democrat, what's going to pop up, what's next, who's out there. Well, let's look at Chandler Scott and see what he's doing, man. I'm interested to see that. Let's talk a little bit more economics and let's talk about investors. We saw the crash and the economic disease in 2008. We see all kind of things happening financially. So why don't you think investors recognize bubbles and the fluctuation of the economy? Why don't they recognize bubbles?
I felt really good yesterday. I think it was yesterday or the day before, there was an announcement about the gentleman economist, American economist, that won the Nobel Prize in economics, a gentleman by the name of Thaler. And one of the things I talk about in my books, the nonfiction books, is this, the irrationality of investors. And there's a difference between how investors invest with, let's say, financial assets versus consumer goods. And I'll give you an example. I'll give you an example I had in the book. If you go to the store and let's use a real popular beer where you live, maybe Lone Star beer, and you go to the store and let's say a six pack of Lone Star is, I'm just going to throw out a number, $6 or $7, you know, and then the next time you went to the store, Larry, it doubled in price and it was $12 or $14. You know, you might not buy it. You know, you might look for another brand or you might buy less of it and so forth. Well, with financial assets, people do the opposite. You know, when financial assets start to go up, they tend to get more aggressive and there's less rationality about what the price is. And so what that tends to create is when you have that optimism, when you have easy credit, which I talk about some of the conditions in the book that allow us to get to that point, and some very, very important historical things that happened even going all the way back to 1971 that's really set all this up. You create these financial asset bubbles and you've got them in place right now. And what tends to burst those bubbles is you don't have the same number of people that are on the, let's say, on the buy side as before. So once you've, let's say, you've converted all the buyers, there's no more new buyers to go into the trend. And then sometimes there's all it takes is one transaction to burst that bubble. The other thing that happens that tends to burst bubbles is the overall social mood of the country or of that financial bubble that we're referring to tends to worsen. And when you look at what happened with Bernard Madoff, and I'm sure some of your listeners know him, Bernard Madoff's scheme was running for years. And there was one gentleman in particular that had fingered him and brought this up to the SEC. He told them exactly what was going on, and the SEC ignored it. Well, then when the social mood turned, then obviously, you know, a big can of whoop-ass came down on Mr. Madoff. There's something in the news right now with a Hollywood mogul by the name of Weinstein, where, again, apparently this behavior had been consistent for many, many years. People knew about it. People shrugged it off. Now, all of a sudden, it became very important for that to happen. You saw the same thing happen, by the way, with the FBI investigation of the NCAA basketball. So, again, these things are known to occur before, but something changed. The social mood changed. It got angrier. And that's why this next financial crisis that we have will be much worse than what you had in 2008. Why? Because the social mood around it, and we know that especially from a political perspective, is much, much worse. So that's why we have to be very, very careful how we move through this next financial crisis, because the underlying social mood, the rancor in the country, the foundation for that will be much worse than it was in 2007 going into 2008.
Can this thing be predicted?
No one can predict this, of course, because if I was able to predict this, I'd be speaking to you from some island in the South Pacific, you know, and I'd be on a hammock looking at the ocean, but I'm not. I'm in my house in St. Louis. But so, yeah, no one has that predictive power to know. But here's what we do know, Larry, is we know the conditions exist right now. We know that there are many, many financial assets that are in a bubble. We know that. Some of your listeners pay attention to something called Bitcoin. I wrote an article about that recently, not about the technology itself. The technology is wonderful, and the underlying principles behind what they're trying to do with Bitcoin and blockchain and distributed ledger, brilliant, beautiful. The problem is that the whole Bitcoin mania and some of the other cryptocurrencies, which now I think there are the numbers over 1,000 of these that are in existence, is that that's part of the mania that exists right now with these other financial asset bubbles that we talked about. So you can't really predict, okay, it's going to happen on this particular date and it's going to look like this. But what we do know is that the risks, the financial risks, have gotten greater over the course of time. And they've really, really, I mean, that financial bubble has inflated particularly significantly since November of 2016.
Wow. America, world, family, church, listen, I'm on with Brother Jim Mosquera, author of Escaping Oz and Observer's Reflections. He has given us truth, wisdom, and knowledge. He's truly revealing some stuff that you didn't know before you listened to this show. Pop-up comment by Miss Jenkins. Miss Jenkins out in Southern Illinois says, this is why I keep all my money in my mattress. Well, baby girl, I'm not going to give them your address, but thank you for sharing. Oh, man, I love it. Love all y'all out there in Southern Illinois as well. Jim, let me ask you, what is the state of the United States of America empire? And are we truly an empire?
That's part of the thesis that I developed earlier with you, Larry, about that we've asked the government to do too much. Part of that is we may have not consciously asked this, but we have unwittingly, let's say, submitted to what Eisenhower warned as the military-industrial complex. He warned about that, I believe, as he was exiting office at the end of his second term. And he warned us to be very, very vigilant of that. Well, of course, when he left office, what happened? Well, we accelerated the war in Vietnam. And for your listeners, I would highly recommend Ken Burns' series about Vietnam. You'll need to dedicate about 15 hours to watching it, but just brilliantly done. And you can kind of see that all of the decisions that went into, you know, prolonging a war, getting into the war, when even the parties that were deep into it understood that there was no chance of winning in the conventional sense of winning, or whatever the definition was of winning. And even though I didn't live in the United States, I had no family members that were involved with Vietnam, I was just very angry watching that, just to see, you know, everything that happened. And we have a continuation of that, if you will, that marriage between the military industrial complex and our foreign policy. If you think about how many countries the United States has military bases, and if you think about how many countries the United States has invaded, has bombed, maybe surreptitiously with drones, you know, the difference between Vietnam and today is, you know, we don't see what happens day to day, you know, in Afghanistan or Iraq. You know, we saw little snippets where the Vietnam news that was on apparently, you know, every night. People could see what was going on. Well, now, you know, the body bags, you know, we don't see them the same way. The drone warfare is something, again, that I talk about a little bit in my fictional book. That's something it's kind of pushed aside. And I don't think Americans have a good view as to, you know, what impacts our foreign policy has to create some of the problems, what's called blowback. I believe Congressman Ron Paul from your state used that term, which is what happens when our foreign policy creates political disturbances overseas. You know, you have blowback, and that blowback sometimes hits that country in and of itself. Look at Iraq today. Look at Afghanistan. Sometimes it bleeds over into Europe, and sometimes it bleeds over the United States. Sometimes it foments, if you will, the creation of radical groups like ISIS and Al-Qaeda. I mean, that's just something that I just don't think most Americans, and that gets back to what I was saying earlier, is asking the right question. You know, you need to ask the question, okay, so just using Afghanistan as an example, what are we doing in Afghanistan? Are we fighting the Taliban? Are the Taliban responsible for any terrorist acts in the United States? I mean, those are just some questions that need to be asked. They need to be asked in the media, whether that's MSNBC, CNN, Fox News, whatever. Those are questions that need to be asked, and they need to ask those of our political leaders. And when you talked about the empire earlier, well, guess what? It costs a lot of money to run an empire, especially when you have troops in many, many different countries, when you're prosecuting wars on the other side of the world. And you got to ask, you know, what's the net of doing all that? And so this is something that happens to empires near the end of that empire, what is considered an empire. And when I say that, and I talk about this in the book, it doesn't mean that the country is going to evaporate and not exist anymore, because the British had an empire, right? And their empire dissolved. Did it mean that Great Britain dissolved? No, it just meant that their influence overseas started to wane. So this is a very critical point for the United States right now, because our foreign policy, again, is creating blowback. Our foreign policy then sometimes overlays economic controls or sanctions or what have you on countries overseas. Well, those countries overseas aren't dumb. And so one of the things they're doing is they're saying, okay, we've had this dependence on the U.S. dollar economically for 40, 50 years. But we also know that the United States can bring a hammer down on us if we don't do what they say. Well, what if we disintermediate the dollar and we start transacting in other currencies? Then the United States sanctions won't have the same effect on us. And again, these are all things that happen towards the end of an empire that, again, people just need to kind of take a step back and realize what's going on.
Man, I love it. Again, folks, I'm on with Jim Mosqueda. He is the author of Escaping Oz and Observer's Reflection. He has so much wisdom and knowledge. He's a business consultant as well. I want you all to get out there on his website, jimmosqueda.com. Check out all that he has to offer. Please, please, please purchase his book. Support this man as an author. Support everything he's doing. And because Jim mentioned Iran or Iraq and Kuwait, and, you know, I was just throwing there Kandahar, and I'll say what's up to the 187th Airlift Squadron. What's up, guys? All y'all that remember Ali al-Salam Air Force Base in Kuwait, man, I always have your six. All y'all that had blood on your boots, man, I always have your six. Thank you. Thank you for everything you did for this country. Anyone who wore this nation's uniform that ever had blood on your boots, until that radio traffic says all clear and we are all home, we got your six, man. Hey, Jim, listen, bro, we're coming down to the last 5 minutes of this episode, man. You have so much understanding, truth, wisdom, and knowledge. the right question for us to ask now as I hand you the mic, whatever God has placed on your heart. But here's my question to you. Who's the man behind the curtain?
The man behind the curtain, or specifically, I was referring to those leaders in the Federal Reserve or central banks worldwide, and these people in these organizations. And again, it's just not something that's well understood. And hopefully through reading the books, people will kind of gain a better understanding of them. You had a congressman in your state, Ron Paul, that talked about, you know, investigating the Fed more, kind of exposing the Fed more about what they do every day and doing an audit. And he was actually very unsuccessful, unfortunately, in that regard, even though he tried to do that. But we need to understand, you know, what sort of financial controls they have over the economy, what influence they exert over the economy. And, you know, we have social problems in this country that this is just Jim Mascara's opinion. They really do center on, you know, financial and economic decisions that have been undertaken by the government and the wizards over the course of time. And this financial inequality that we have in this country is not a problem of capitalism. And that's a great fear that I have, is that someone will see, well, you know, we have this great inequality, these injustices. It must be capitalism's fault. That's not true. We've actually kind of bastardized capitalism over the course of time, because, as I mentioned, that political spectrum, we're keeping moving over to one side of all the isms. And understanding, you know, how the financial markets work, and more importantly, how our money system works in this country, is so important. Because once you understand that and understand, you know, with the monetary system that we have, you'll realize why we have some of the inequalities that we do and why we have these economic swings. Again, we're always going to have economic swings, but the violence of the swings and the unintended consequences are much more exacerbated because of the monetary systems that we have. And the Fed is squarely in the middle of all that.
Get the book, Escaping Oz, An Observer's Reflection. Support the man, the author, the businessman, Jim Mascara. Brother, it was such a blessing and an honor to have you on the show, man. I got to get those other books, man, and have you back on the show. My mouth is literally watering over this 2020 book. I got to get that.
Well, it's been a great honor for me to be on your show, Mr. Stevenson, and hopefully your listeners will get something positive out of this. And again, we can read, learn, and, you know, and hopefully ask the right questions.
Absolutely. So, asking the right questions. What are we at? Our numbers right now are 312K live. So all of you listening, ask the right questions. So we got 312,000 that need to ask the right questions. And if you need to ask them, you can contact Brother Jim and ask him, the author of Escaping Oz, An Observer's Reflection. Brother, God bless you. Thank you so much for everything that you do, and may God continue to bless everything that you do.
Thank you very much, sir. Thank you very much, sir.
Man, what a blessing, what an honor, what a pleasure to have Brother Jim on, man. Check out the book again, man, Escaping Oz. You heard my review. 5 beards, 2 cowboy hats, and a hallelujah saint. He's on down the road. Man, that's just, I love when people just really get deep and are passionate about what they're talking about, especially when they've been blessed to produce something literary, and like a literary genius as Jim is, and produce the book Escaping Oz, An Observer's Reflection. I'm going to get the series, man, have Jim back on, and we're just going to walk y'all through it again. You're going to get the carrot. You got to buy the steak. Go buy the steak. Go buy the first of a 7-course meal, Escaping Oz, An Observer's Reflection. Go to Jim Mascara. .com. Once again, that's Jim Mascara, MOSQUERA.com. I know some of y'all went to public school like me, and you need it phonetically spelled, not hooked on phonics, just phonetically spelled. Hey, I'm going to come right back at you, man, after this brief commercial. I'm going to go get me some more conservative brew. I'll be right back at you.
The Bearded Black Cowboy. Letting the truth be told, the beard is not politically confused.